It's time for a more in-depth look at today's news. It's time to find out who's pulling the strings. It's time for the Behind the Curtain podcast with your host, author Jeff Reynolds.
Hey everyone, welcome into episode 11 of Behind the Curtain. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds, and right off the bat, I want to apologize for not dropping this episode last Wednesday. There were a string of scheduling snafus, and I personally had a hellish week dealing with in-laws in the hospital, insurance claims, and all sorts of other time sucks. Thanks for sticking with the Behind the Curtain podcast. This week's episode is absolutely worth the wait. So this week, I have two powerful and thoughtful women on my podcast. My first guest is my good friend and my boss, Paula Bouillard. Paula is the managing editor for PJ Media, where I frequently contribute columns. We talk about the evolution of center-right media, the continued need to provide an alternative to the biased mainstream media, and what the future might hold. Paula stuck around for our bonus segment, exclusive for our Patreon patrons, talking always Trumpers, never Trumpers, and the Trump Train 2020. Hint, Jen Rubin and Bill Kristol made it into our discussion. You can follow Paula on Twitter at pbouillard, which is P-B-O-L-Y-A-R-D. This segment and other exclusive content is at patreon.com/behindthecurtainwithjeffreynolds. For a low monthly fee, you gain early access to the free podcast, along with exclusive content found nowhere else. My second segment is a conversation with an activist in East Portland, which goes largely ignored by the downtown Portland elites. Her name is Angela Todd, and she's made national headlines for pushing back against the apathy Portland leaders have shown towards our homeless crisis. She founded the Montevilla Initiative, a gathering of neighbors in her neighborhood to talk about what's going on in the streets. She talks about how dangerous the streets have become, how City Hall ignores her, the attacks she's faced from national media, and something truly unique, how she and her neighbors organize groups to stop talking to each other and go to talk to people on their streets. It's an eye-opening conversation and something I've personally wanted to do for a long time. Well, Angela has done it, and you really need to hear the results of her efforts. You can read about her good work at Montevilla.org or on Facebook at facebook.com/Montevilla Initiative. Don't forget to subscribe to the Behind the Curtain podcast wherever you listen to it, and please leave a positive rating. The more subscribers and the better ratings, the higher Behind the Curtain will rank on podcast services like iTunes and Google Podcasts, among many others. I'm happy to report that my book continues to generate buzz. It's called Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. I continue to be in demand for radio interviews, and I have another speaking engagement this week. Search for the book in stores or online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Simon & Schuster. It's available in hardback, Kindle, or Nook now. Check out whoownsthedems.com for more information. Welcome back to the Behind the Curtain podcast. My guest for this segment is Paula Bouillard, who is the managing editor of PJ Media and my boss. Paula, welcome in.
Hi, Jeff. Good to talk to you.
Yes, yeah, it's great.
Make sure you emphasize the boss part.
Important. Yes, it's very important that I treat you properly throughout this entire process.
Kiss the ring and whatever.
So I wanted to talk to you today for this segment about the state of current conservative media and where we're going. You know, you and I kind of got into the movement about the same time, right?
Right.
Yeah. And you know, through the blogging process and Tea Party process and railing against the mainstream media. And I wanted to take the opportunity today to talk to you about the state of the mainstream media and then also the state of conservative media, because we've seen so many changes throughout the decade that we've been involved. So,
right.
Let's first talk about how you and I got involved. I think you and I probably met first at a blog con, is that right?
You're going to ask me to remember stuff.
Yeah,
I think it was something like that. But yeah, that was a huge thing back years ago, and you know, a lot of networking going on, and people trying to find their way in blogging, and it was called blogging back then. It's funny, we now call it conservative media or center right media. Nobody talks about blogging anymore, but. So that sort of reflects a lot of changes that have gone on.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because back in the day when we first got involved, there were so many organizations and so many people trying to promote blogging as an alternative to the mainstream media because we needed more voices. We needed more people putting out the alternate view from what the mainstream said. And now it seems like that's kind of faded for a bit. What do you think the future is of our fight back against the mainstream media?
Well, I think we're not in a good position at this point, simply because, you know, you hear about people being blacklisted, websites being blacklisted, people being pulled off platforms. And I mean, I hate to be a pessimist, but I think that's probably going to escalate. And we've seen a lot of behind the scenes, these shadowy organizations targeting advertisers for websites, conservative websites. Now they call us hateful websites, of course, and and in a lot of instances, they're listening. Advertisers who are trying to sell a product want to avoid things that are controversial, and if they perceive conservative media as controversial, or it may be as simple as, you know, a lot of advertisers are saying we don't want to run our ads on sites that have political content, left or right. And
right,
that's sort of
kind of a cop out.
Yeah, I understand it in a way. If you're selling widgets and you just want to sell your widgets, and then next thing you know, you're on a site that's, you know, talking about a political issue one way or another, and then people start calling and complaining and saying, why are you supporting this or that? And it used to be you could just advertise in the local newspaper and, you know, it wasn't all that controversial, but, you know, things have changed now. And I think another issue, you know, now that we're going back to the old blogger days, when you and I started, I don't know about you, but I sure wasn't getting paid for blogging.
No.
And, you know, it was a labor of love for a lot of us, and we were activists at heart. And then things started changing, and people found that they could get paid for blogging. And, you know, there were investors who thought maybe this is going to be the next big thing, and they sunk a lot of money into it. Well, then a couple of years ago, the ad bubble burst, and now you see sites dropping like flies. And I just heard about another conservative site today. I can't say what it is, but it's probably going to be shuttering in the next couple of months.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, we may be going back to the model where we're just doing this as a labor of love.
Well, and that's kind of why I started the podcast too, right? Is that, you know, it's a new technology. A lot of people are getting into that, and there's a real need for conservative voices because it's again overwhelmed by liberal voices. So that's kind of why I started this, and it's a labor of love, and I'm trying to find a way to monetize it. But you know, you're just feeling your way in the dark, like just like in the days of blogging, you know.
Right. Yeah. It's like what goes around comes around. History repeats itself.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, you talk about almost the weaponization of how consumers will protest ads on certain websites and that kind of thing, and, you know, not wanting to run their ads on political sites. And that goes back to the coordination between, like, the Southern Poverty Law Center and Media Matters and all of those groups. And, you know, I wrote about it a lot in my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Go buy it now, please. But, you know, that's all of this stuff is being coordinated. I'm sure you see that at PJ Media, right?
Right. We haven't seen necessarily coordinated targeting of our site, but we sure report on it a lot. And we, Tyler O'Neill reports on the Southern Poverty Law Center and their shenanigans. The good news there is they've been exposed in the last couple of years, and people are beginning to realize, wow, this maybe is not an impartial arbiter of truth and justice in the American way. It's just the opposite, actually.
Yeah, really. It is true, because I think it's been almost a decade that they were actually removed from the FBI's list of trusted organizations to track hate groups.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's taking a long time. It's taking a lot longer than it should have. What they've been up to has been apparent for many years, but it's just now getting the publicity it deserves.
Well, and they started out with great intentions, right? They were representing folks who were targets of civil rights violations. They were helping to represent them legally, but they morphed into something, in the 80s, that was just nothing but a fundraising organization.
Right. And they've made millions and millions of dollars doing that and, you know, from presenting themselves as, you know, we're just battling the Ku Klux Klan here. That's all we're doing. When in reality, they're targeting Christian organizations in particular. That's one of their main targets because, you know, they believe what Christians believe about the Bible is hateful and it shouldn't be allowed in civil society. And they want to silence us.
Yeah, talk more about that. Why do you think that Christians are being targeted so much these days?
Well, it's interesting, and it's easy to throw out that, well, it's the LGBTQ whatever agenda, but that's really what it is. There is a powerful group of activists, and as you said, many of them coordinate, and they are completely opposed to Christian teaching on sexuality issues. And they think, you know, they, in their mind, they think it's very much the same as racism. So if you are against gay marriage, you might as well be parading around your town in a KKK hood. And, you know, they, and I don't see that stopping. I mean, we're on some email lists together and I ranted about this last week about how I think, you know, some of us are probably not even going to be able to have jobs, you know, anything that requires a certification, medical certification, you know, bar associations, things like that.
Any licensing test through the state, right? I mean, that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, it'll probably start there and local. And, you know, you're in trouble out there.
Oh, my God.
Not as bad here yet.
No idea.
But yeah, you need to learn to work with your hands if you don't already know how. Although I suspect you do.
Yep. So in an ideal world where we had not all these activists running things and we could think rationally about these issues, it seems to me that folks who believe in religious freedom and folks who believe in LGBT rights should be able to coexist.
You know, it's funny because they're the ones running around with the coexist bumper stickers and proclaiming how tolerant they are. And they're like, I've heard it compared to the Puritans. You know, they've got their list of rules you must obey, and if you violate their rules, burn the witch. You know, there's middle ground for them.
That's been a problem I've noticed for a long time now, is that the folks who were oppressed supposedly by American society don't want to end oppression. They just want to be in charge of the oppression.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We ran a story at PJ Media. Megan Fox wrote it last night. I don't know if you saw this, about a Pennsylvania lawmaker who went to a Planned Parenthood clinic, and there was an elderly woman praying and saying the rosary. Mm. And he just got in her face with the camera and tried to shame her and chased her around and called her names. And this is the guy who's in the General Assembly of Pennsylvania, and he ran he's the first openly gay member of the General Assembly, and his Twitter profile says he's an LGBTQ activist. That's his,
of course,
his own descriptor. And so here he is running around the legislature. Last year, Vice President Pence was coming to Philadelphia, and he posted a picture of himself giving Pence the finger.
Wow.
Like, classy. That, you know, somebody needs to, do they have no code of conduct in the Pennsylvania legislature that they allow this nonsense?
Well, I mean, who's going to enforce it, right? I mean, I don't know what the makeup of the legislature is in Pennsylvania, but
I think they've got a Republican majority.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, you certainly he has his right to free speech and his right to protest and all of the constitutional rights that we know of, but you know, you don't make yourself look better by being that way. You know, that's right. What he just makes himself look stupid.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the interesting thing is I think they truly believe that everyone agrees with them, that it's just a small minority instead of half the country. Did you see over the weekend the Senate Democrats posted a poll about who you'd rather have as a Supreme Court justice? Yeah, the choices were Ruth Bader Ginsburg and
Brett Kavanaugh.
And Kavanaugh just ran away with it, and they had to take. They ended up taking down the tweet, and then they did it again this morning. I can't even remember what it was. But they posted something else, and it was 50-50.
Yeah,
but they really.
Yeah, it was the one over the weekend was even worse. It was 70-30 in favor of Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the thing. Whoever's running their social media doesn't know other people like him. You know, that intern, weekend intern, whoever it was, doesn't know anyone who doesn't believe the same things he does. So they are living in this bubble, believing that there's a huge majority that agrees with them, and it's simply not true. And they keep running into these walls, doing stupid things, stunts that, yeah, you're right, it makes them look stupid.
Yeah,
or whatever. You didn't use the word stupid, but you used a nicer word.
No, I said stupid. I wasn't very nice. But this is why I think Donald Trump is going to win re-election and probably win the popular vote along the way, because you look at the 30 or 90 or however many Democratic candidates there are for president, and trying to outdo each other so far to the left, because they think that actually plays with the general voter. And I think that as long as the economy is as healthy as it is today, although there are signs that that may not be the case, but assuming we keep the status quo until 2020, I don't see how people will flock to the Democratic Party with what they're trying to push right now.
Right. Well, you know, I wonder to what extent they see the writing on the wall. They know the economy's good. They know Trump's popularity is increasing. And I think this crazy socialism, Green New Deal, it's like a moonshot for them. They're going to give it a try. Maybe they'll crash and burn, but you know, there's an outside chance maybe that'll catch on. I don't know. It's hard to know what's in their minds, but I wonder if it's some of that.
Well, you know, and that makes me think, you know, back to the idea of conservative media. How big a gift has Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar been to the right?
The gifts that just keep on giving.
Yeah.
There is a risk that Republicans, conservatives, we overplay our hand there.
Right.
And, you know, then she becomes some kind of martyr, or, you know, people genuinely start to feel sympathy for her. And so I think we've got to be a little careful there, but goodness, it's hard to resist that.
Yeah.
Well, it's just so nutty.
You know, it's ironic. My observation of AOC is that she's actually mastered the art of what Donald Trump does. You know, it's mm-hmm. all press is good press, right?
Hugely. She does it hugely. Yep, I think you're absolutely right there.
Yeah, yeah. So you're right. I mean, if we give her too much oxygen, people are going to start thinking of her as mainstream. And if we bully her too much, then, you know, people are going to be empathetic with her, even though, you know, what she says is still insane.
Right. Yeah, that's the danger there.
Yep. So let's talk a little bit about PJ Media. It's gone through several iterations. It's kind of indicative of the center-right media in general, right? I mean, it started off in, 2004 as just it was pajamas TV, right?
Well, it was pajamas media at first, and Roger Simon and Charles, why can't I think of his name? I don't know. It'll come to me. They started it as conglomeration of different blogs. So Instapundit was one of the blogs on there. Roger had his own blog. Roger Kimball had his blog. And then there were some left-wing contributors, too. And yeah, it was supposed to be sort of a diverse marketplace of ideas. And then ultimately what happened is they started sharing ad revenues. And as I've been told, the liberals were not happy with the system, and they took their ball and went home. And so then it became more of a center right. Yeah, it went through, you know, a couple different name changes. PJ TV was a spinoff of PJ Media. So that was, we were in video media, like the podcasting thing and YouTube thing, before that was actually a thing. You know,
right,
everybody's
right.
sort of doing it now, and we were kind of one of the first ones to get in there and do that. It ultimately didn't work out, but I think we were just a little too early to the game. The world wasn't ready for us yet. Like
You were Michael definitely behind J. Fox the curve, or ahead
yeah,
of the curve, I should say.
Ahead of it, yeah. Like Michael yeah, yeah. J. Fox in Back to the Future. They're not ready for you yet.
weren't ready for that, I guess.
Yeah, and as you're aware, we were purchased by Salem Media. Acquired, actually, is the word. Got to get the terminology right. So that mm-hmm. happened on March 18th, and we've had, you know, some changes, mostly behind the scenes, but on the front end, I don't think readers have noticed much different. Almost all of our writers have stuck around, and our content hasn't changed. So that's a good thing. I'm glad PJ Media is still PJ Media.
Yeah. Obviously, there was a whole thing with Red State last year, and there was some trepidation about, just acquisition in general. Like, it always seems to change the character, and it's good so far from my perspective that things haven't changed very much. I still enjoy contributing, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have you, too. And there have been no... edicts from on high saying you have to run this or don't run that. So, one of the things I've always loved about PJ Media is we let everybody have their say. And mm-hmm. even if I don't agree with it, which a lot of the stuff I don't agree with.
we've talked about that offline before.
Yeah, right. But it's always been that way since Roger started it. And, during the primaries, we fought it out. We had, hardcore pro Rubio, hardcore pro Trump, no hardcore Obama people. But I know that might be a bridge too far if somebody went that direction. Some websites that we won't name have gone that direction. But and I don't think it's a successful business model to anger your readers constantly.
Yeah, no, that's what ESPN does, right? And, I've read about this for PJ so many mm-hmm. times. They anger half the nation thinking that they're going woke is going to make them money, and it does exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, we do try to be sensitive to our readers, and I read the comments, and we have a daily live blog, and, if people ask me questions there, I'm generally jumping in and answering them and dealing with complaints and why did you do this? Why did you do that with the comments? Why did you write this article? And, I'm happy to have those conversations with people because they're our bread and butter, right?
Well, you're braver than I am. I almost never look at the comments because, I value my self-esteem.
Yeah, I know. They always say rule number one in blogging is, don't read the comments, right?
Right.
But, I just kind of feel as managing editor, I need to,
stay on top of it.
Stay on top of it and get the pulse of our readers. And, and a lot of the criticism is just people being angry and not very nice. And, sometimes comments get deleted because they're full of swearing.
Yeah, well, that's not good.
Yeah, no, but, you do pick up some nuggets and we do sometimes make changes. Like, one thing, we had a lot of complaints about the font color on our site was too light for people to see. And as a person of age, a certain age, I can agree that I thought it was true. And so we made that change last week. So we have a darker font color.
Oh, I didn't even notice actually. So that's good to know.
Well, you must not be a man of a certain age yet.
Oh, I am. I'm wearing bifocals right now. So.
Oh, there you go. You have a pair in every room.
No. I actually just wear these 100% of the time.
Oh, okay, that's easier.
Yeah. No, I got rid of the peepers for the actual bifocal glasses. So. But
that's right.
I was actually rocking the look where I had my regular glasses and then the peepers over them, and then I did that like twice and realized this is ridiculous. I need to break down.
Yeah, I finally went with the contacts. I've got two different contacts, one for near and one for far. It took a little while to get used to it, but it's not bad. I think I see better than with the glasses.
Yeah. I actually have multifocal contacts. Those work really well, so mm-hmm. I might look into that.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to me.
All right, we're done with the old people problem segment of
that's
the podcast.
That's right. This is the way to get that younger demographic. That's what I'm aiming for.
That should work.
So you mentioned in the early days with PJ Media, they had liberal and conservative contributors, and it makes me think of Huffington Post because they're the 800-pound gorilla on the left. But they've, through the mm-hmm. years, had conservative contributors as well. John Hawkins is one of the ones that was with them for quite a while. That probably didn't make him terribly popular on the left, but there's something about getting outside of our echo chamber and being able to put the message out there. Even if people disagree with it, they get exposed to it. So how do you think
right.
we should do that on our side these days?
It's a tough question because, like I mentioned a few minutes ago, you can't just anger your readers constantly. And, when you run things that are contrary to what the majority of your readers believe, it's sort of a powder keg you're creating there. That said, I think within conservative media, there's a spectrum. There are people who would give a kidney for President Trump, and there are others who would not, to say the least.
Maybe take one of his kidneys.
Yeah, by force. but I think at least having a little bit of a spectrum within conservatism, and as you're well aware, that's even that in some areas is not allowed to even say anything critical about the president, which I think, let alone in a free society, but in a conservative blogosphere atmosphere, we ought to be able to have those conversations. We shouldn't be afraid of those conversations. I think where some people have gone wrong, and you've seen this with Bill Kristol and Jen Rubin, is they've just become obsessed with it, and they can't let it go, and they've become so one note that's all they talk about. But then on the other hand, you have people in the pro-Trump camp who are the polar opposite, and they can't bring themselves to criticize anything. One person I really appreciate is David Goldman, who writes under the name Spangler at PJ Media, and he's a huge fan of the president, a big supporter, but he's been critical of, in particular, his policy toward China and big tech and infrastructure. So I appreciate having that kind of balance. I tend to respect people who can sort of give both sides of things more rather than someone who is an obvious cheerleader for one camp or the other,
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great way to kick off our bonus segment for our Patreon patrons. Let's dive into that, the cult-like atmosphere that surrounds both Never Trumpism and Always Trumpism, and where the folks in the middle can go with that and sort of unpack that, because it's been a really weird environment ever since the primary started in 2015. So we'll make make that the beginning of our Patreon segment coming up, which is patreon.com/behindthecurtain with Jeff Reynolds. But we'll wrap up the free segment here right now with a question about the current state and the future state of the media. You look at Fox News, and there, you had a piece out just the other day criticizing Fox News about the homeschooling movement. So should we rely on Fox News as our sole, you know, like we want to have something out there that pushes back against the mainstream media, and Fox News kills the ratings because they do that. But then again, there's a danger in only getting your information from the echo chamber. So I guess the question I'm trying to ask is what should our perspective be on how we treat the media and how we participate in the media?
I think the basic feeling we ought to have toward the media is suspicion, whether it's from the left or right, and, you know, trust but verify. There's a lot of stuff out there, even on, you know, as we've seen with the New York Times and CNN and correction after correction about the Mueller report. And but on our side, we have that too. And, you know, you mentioned an article I wrote about Fox last week where they just basically did a hit piece on homeschooling that really surprised me. But, and it was interesting when I wrote that, the comments filled up with people saying Fox News isn't conservative anymore. And
that's been a complaint for a while.
Yeah, it has. You know, part of it is, you know, Shepard Smith, we all know that he's not the most conservative dude at Fox, and right. They've hired Marie Harf and April Ryan, and so people think that there's a drift there. But I think part of that is also what a conservative is has really evolved. I don't even know if it's evolved. It's become so murky. If you ask people what a conservative is, you'll get it's always been that way, but even more so. You know, it used to be you could say, well, conservatives believe this on trade and conservatives believe this on the deficit, and the lines are so blurred anymore. So when people say Fox isn't conservative, some of them are saying that they criticize Trump sometimes, you know, and they shouldn't be doing that at all. And other people, when they say Fox isn't conservative, means that they're on Team Trump and basically cheerleaders for the president.
So. right. And we know that Trump isn't the most conservative president we've ever had. But, you know, and you can debate his effectiveness. And he's done some great things, judiciary, regulatory, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm, right.
But I don't think anybody would claim that he's the most conservative guy in the world.
No, certainly not a budget hawk or.
right.
But yeah, I mean, you can look at various issues, but and that just shows how not only conservatism, but the Republican Party has, you know, it's largely become, which isn't abnormal for the party to become a reflection of the candidate and then later the president, because that's basically their job description of the RNC is to support Trump.
Right.
Whereas conservatism, which we both consider ourselves conservatives, that ought to have different standards. I think, you know, conservatism ought not to be necessarily in, you know, just propagandists for the president. But, you know, and you alluded to this, that that's happening in some cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, I first of all, I find that very boring to read and to listen to, you know, and I'm not going to name any names, but you just keep repeating the same thing over and never any balanced reporting. I think it's boring.
Yeah.
But back to your original question, I think we ought to invest ourselves in reading a lot of different opinions and different takes on the news, switch to CNN once in a while, as painful as it is. Just because we need to, how do we debate their ideas if we don't even know what their ideas are? How do we win this war of ideas if we're not even listening to what they're saying? Yeah,
if we're not exchanging ideas, we can't win the war of ideas.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I think that's important.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Shep Smith, and I can't stand the guy, and so I never watch. And frankly, I don't watch a lot of Fox News. I get my information from a variety of different sources. But I will say that I appreciate the presence of Juan Williams on the network, because he does give that that alternate perspective, and then we can debate what he's saying and whether we agree or not, or you know, understand what the other side is saying.
Yeah, and you know, as much as I don't agree with him a lot of the time, he's not a bitter partisan as some others. You know, other people like Marie Harf, having been a former Obama staffer, and there's so much baggage there, where Juan Williams has been a journalist, so you don't have that same kind of...
Although it's at NPR, so there's some bag.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's legitimate. But, and I think, too, that, you know, Juan has a son who's conservative, so I think that tempers that urge to just go off the deep end.
Well, he's always been, to me, he's always been thoughtful and honest, which is not which is in short supply on that side.
Yes. Indeed it is.
Yeah,
I appreciate that about him too. And, you know, there are some others too. And, you know, I think you just have to, like I said, trust but verify, and, you know, read different sources if what you're hearing is true.
Mm-hmm. Sounds right to me. Okay, well, that wraps up our free segment with Paula Bolliard, who's the managing editor of PJ Media. And for more information on this, and we're going to unpack this, the state of the conservative movement in our bonus segment for Patreon patrons only. So check that out at patreon.com/behindthecurtain with Jeff Reynolds. Paula, I want to thank you for appearing on my podcast.
Thanks, Jeff. It was fun.
Yeah, it was. All right, we'll do this again sometime.
Let's do it.
If you like this podcast, the best way you can support it is by leaving a rating and subscribing. And don't forget to buy my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Now it's on to the Oregon story of the week with Angela Todd of the Montevilla Initiative. Okay, welcome back to the Oregon segment of this week's Behind the Curtain podcast. My guest today is Angela Todd, who is actually the chair of the Montevilla Initiative. Angela is an interior designer, but she has started an organization that is taking on some of the biggest urban blight we're seeing in Portland. We're seeing all kinds of stuff. We're making national news for all the wrong reasons. And Angela Todd is kind of leading the fight in Northeast Portland, a part of town that often gets ignored by City Hall. So, Angela, welcome in.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. I've been rooting for you from afar for quite some time now, watching all of the stuff that you're doing. So why don't you tell us how you got started?
Well, it's interesting. You had said Montevilla Initiative, actually, we came together as a group of neighbors that wanted to get to know one another, have social outings, affect livability. I guess I shouldn't say affect livability. I would just say that livability became one of the things that we all seem to be concerned about, based on what's going on in Portland at the moment, and also some of the situations in East Portland with our unhoused community. So that has become a part of one of the initiatives, if you will, to use that word again, that we do have. Sure. That we want to make a difference about.
So this is more of a social kind of thing, right? I mean, it's just looking at what's going on the streets of Portland. I don't even know. What is your party affiliation?
Me? I consider myself very independent. I have a hard time with either title, whether it be right or left. I think that based on whatever the exact topic is, I might have an opinion that would sway either way.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that you say that, because I think that's what people make this issue.
Right.
Is it a liberal issue, or is it conservatives are blaming the liberals and the liberals are blaming the conservatives? And I think that we need, like, all wings, if you will, to figure out this issue. And I will say that I think that if in all things in history, as we are swinging too far one way or the other, we got problems. Frankly, that's what I think. So I think that's why I see myself as a bit more center.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's one of those things, like, you're talking about drug use on the streets and homelessness and addiction issues and mental health issues, and this shouldn't be a political issue at all. This should be one of those things that we all agree needs to be fixed.
Right. Now, this is what I think this is really fun to talk about. So there was a point in sort of our socialness as neighbors that we started to just have discussions about what's going on. And what's being said by our city officials and our county officials is that Portland housing is expensive, and so people are being displaced, and so we need affordable housing. And as we started to talk in our neighborhood, some of us are pretty strong women, and we were like, maybe we should just go talk to these people that are out on the street, start getting to know them, figure out who they are, figure out what their story is. Like, is that true?
Right.
Because what we were noticing was bicycles that were being chopped up, Amazon packages at their camps, needles, et cetera, as we started to interact and talk to them. And it's interesting, once you meet somebody who is unhoused for a period of time and they start to fellowship with you, sometimes they begin to tell you a pretty interesting story. And what we, first of all, I think that people on the street need our help, but I don't think that it is fair to assume that it's because everyone has been displaced. As a matter of fact, I seldom find that. I often find someone who is self-identifying themselves is having mental issues, or they are identifying themselves as an addict. And some of them are also just are sort of like, they don't really want to be in the system, right? They're screw the system mm-hmm. doesn't work, kind of the anarchy sort of feeling.
Well, and they have a point there. I mean, there's not much working in the system.
Right. I think that one of the things I'm troubled with is that we need an approach that is multifaceted for this issue. But I will go to, and this is where I get confused sometimes by some people as being, you know, if you're labeled in Portland, for example, as a conservative or a right winger or a Trump follower, that's like a bad thing. I'm from the Midwest, by the way. And so it's interesting how in different parts of the country, it's negative or positive, whatever you happen to be.
Right. There's tolerance for some views, but not others.
Right, exactly. I find that I feel that we need boundaries. You know, I've lived here since 1996, and I lived in Northwest Portland in the downtown area for the first 7 years. Mm-hmm. And we definitely knew some people that were homeless by choice in that area. And they would, and I knew them by name, and I would sometimes talk to them, and you know, some of them were people who picked up your cans and wanted you to leave them out so they knew where they were and that other people didn't see them, those type of things. But they were not people that had, you know, trash thrown over places. They weren't, I don't know where they were going to the bathroom, to be honest with you, but it was not, it was not.
I don't want to know.
and I never saw a needle. I never saw a needle then. And so now it's a really different story. And, you know, one of the things that I really want to get across for anyone who's listening to this that I think is the most important thing to say, and I'm jumping around a little bit, but this part's important, is that we've got to do something, not because it physically looks bad, like, oh, that's a problem. That's not it. We got to do something because it is really unsafe out there for people that are out on the street. Like, really bad. Like, the man in the 90s that I knew, you know, David would be victimized today. You know, it takes a woman, I've heard this stat several times, 35 hours to be attacked whenever they're out on the street. And
holy cow.
We have also met, you know, men, older people, et cetera. They have to take all their belongings with them if they go around and get cans or what, I keep bringing that up, but whatever they're doing during the day, they've told me time and time again, I cannot leave anything. I have had men and women tell me that in their tent sleeping, people will come in their tent at night and take their things and attack them.
Oh my God.
You know, so we think that this is a problem for us. Like, this is a major, major problem for the people that are out there. It's sort of like, I haven't been to prison or anything like that, but from, you know, different things that I know, it's like prison culture. You know,
yeah.
It's like, snitches get in trouble, you know, that's a whole nother thing. Like, we're not catching and releasing people. So if somebody attacks somebody, let's say a woman, let's say a man, doesn't matter, that's homeless, and they report it, they know that person's going to be right back in front of their face within less than a few hours, and they know that they're going to get it worse, and so they say nothing. It's horrible.
That's really an interesting point, too, because here in Portland, we really have an anti-cop attitude, an anti-police attitude. In fact, two people that were recently elected to city council were anti-cop activists.
Right, so, absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's really a problem of, you know, what are the actual solutions? You know, another issue that occurred to me is... my understanding, I could be wrong on this, and maybe you have better information, but my understanding is there's somewhere over 10,000 homeless people in Portland now, which is a huge explosion from, say, 5 years ago, but the vast majority of them aren't even from Oregon. Isn't that true?
So I have a hard time with the number because I'm not sure if they're talking about people that are currently like being helped or in shelter versus like literally on the street camping. So I'm not really sure the accurate number, but I will tell you from my own experiment, my own talking to people, my own averages, that there is a high number of people that are from out of the area. I would say 50% of the people that I've talked to didn't grow up here.
Right.
So it is very common. Some of them that we've gotten to know over time really well, where they're super open with us. They are absolutely there. It's like everybody knows that Portland's easy on crime.
Right.
Everybody knows that Portland's easy on camping. And so it sort of opens the doors for it, you know?
Yeah, no, I'll share an anecdote with you. I drive Uber and Lyft occasionally on the side to make a little extra money. And a couple of years ago, I gave a ride to a guy from L.A. visiting, and he said that 15 years ago, so this would have been about 20 years ago now, he had a job with the Social Security office in L.A. County. So he dealt with homeless people every day, handing out their checks and that kind of thing. And he said it was amazing to him. Every single homeless person he ever talked to either had come from or was going to Portland, because even back then we had a reputation for being friendly, being easy to get along, easy to live a homeless lifestyle.
So this will blow your mind. If you are a standard Portlander and you're caught drinking and driving, you're going to serve more jail time than if you're high in a stolen car and caught with drugs.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true.
I mean, like, you just said afterwards, like, yeah, that's right. But I mean, like, really, get that.
No, that's
like,
not
that's
normal.
Insane. You know, it's, you know, we have, one of the things that people blame Mayor Wheeler on this all the time, and I'm not suggesting that Mayor Wheeler perhaps couldn't do some more effective things. But, you know, we have an entire, number one, he is as powerful as the other city council people, number one. Number two, the real people that are responsible for human services and the homeless problem in Portland is our county. And did you know that our county stopped funding part of our jail? We have two sections of our jail closed down because they say that we don't have enough money. And we have officers that are giving people citations for breaking and entering.
Right.
Like, you know, they'll just sort of get a notice that says no arrest today. And basically, unless you sort of stab somebody and you have a certain amount level of crime, absolutely nobody gets arrested.
Yeah.
I mean, it's we have a guy in our neighborhood, between him and his family. I'm not kidding. They're a family of crime. All the police officers know who they are. He has himself 7 open warrants, and
oh
he was
God.
Just picked up the other day. And I could literally show you his car. I could walk you over there if I could walk you over there.
Sure, absolutely.
And, he has, people bring him stuff. There's, you know, it's like breaking and entering, drugs, like stolen vehicles, etc. There's like Amazon packages right now out by his car. No kidding. I don't know where he is. He's probably robbing somebody. And we can't get this guy put in jail. I mean, it's and the officers, you know, like the network response team, people call it NRT, who aren't part of the dispatch. They're, unless it's really busy, you know, they're sort of assigned to certain neighborhoods to take care of larger crime activity. They can arrest him, you know, and he's just released like in 2 hours. Like it's a game. So our police officers literally are, they're just spinning or they're just become ineffective because they just don't, it's like, whatever, you know, doesn't matter.
Yeah. Why would you throw yourself into arresting somebody if you know it's just not going to work?
Yeah. And I've been criticized for this because people stop listening, but you know, I don't believe that being homeless is a crime, but I believe
right.
that criminal activity needs to be prosecuted.
Yeah,
and I think
crime is a crime. I mean,
crime is a crime. I don't care what your housing status is. And, you know, people misconstrue this like, oh, you know, you want to arrest people for trespassing. You know, did I say that? No. I'm saying if you're stealing packages, stealing cars, stealing bicycles, breaking into people's houses or assaulting people, which all of that has happened in my neighborhood I literally could name off 15 incidences in the last 45 days like that. We do not have arrests most of the time. And if we do, they're back out. It's a joke.
Yeah, it is a joke.
This is what's going on in East Portland, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like there's different types of parenting, and we all know a parent who sort of goes, oh, but Johnny's a good boy, and Johnny, you know, and Johnny's acting up in school, and Johnny's like hitting kids on the playground, and Johnny's like cheating on tests, and Johnny's like, and Johnny doesn't have any standards because his mom's a sweetie. And this is the epitome of our city. Like we need some boundaries. We need some dad presence. You know, like, yeah, that's, you know, and I think I want to be loving. Like my dad was very loving, but you just did not cross certain boundaries with dad, you know,
right.
That's the way it was.
Yeah. I've made that point for a long time that, Portland refuses to make adult decisions, and we keep electing people and we have this sort of adolescent attitude all across the city in a lot of different ways. And this is another one of them, you know. It's, and just real quick for the listeners who aren't familiar, we're talking about the Montevilla neighborhood, which is basically northeast and southeast 82nd Avenue. So 82nd has always had its issues, but it's gotten really bad over, say, the past 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, we border Mount Tabor.
Yep.
I'm technically in the Tabor neighborhood on the map. I'm a half block into that Tabor area.
Okay.
But we border Tabor, and then we go up to the 205, and then we go to Halsey, which is essentially 84, and then Powell. So,
yep.
Or excuse me, I think it might be Division. I'm so embarrassed.
I think you're right. It's Division because the
yes,
Jade
Division,
District is
Powell.
Down there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, we, you know, it's Montevilla Initiative. We also talk to, you know, the Lentz neighborhood, Brentwood, Darlington, Hazelwood, Rose City Park. I mean, this is like going on everywhere.
Right.
I suppose in some ways we sort of assimilated as a group. We were one of the earlier groups that came together. I mean, Lentz was too, but I just mean like Hazelwood and Rose City Park have been coming together after us.
Mm-hmm.
But it is essential for, you know, neighbors to start being aware of what's going on. You know, we have some avenues via Facebook and so forth where we share information. We know where people are. You know, it's interesting what information you can share. Like we've had bicycles recovered. We're not doing we haven't had enough success, by the way. I'm not even thinking we've had enough success, but we have had some things where we've had people caught and arrested. But again, they just kick them right back out. And that's our county. That's not our police, and that's not our mayor. So, and that's what's crazy, because most people couldn't even name one name of a county commissioner, or maybe one. Can you name them all? And, you know, do you know?
So I know I can't.
I think people need a civic lesson for sure.
Because,
you know, because Wheeler's taking all the heat, and actually, he's a mouth. I don't mean to be disrespectful to him. I'm talking about the position. The position is a mouthpiece,
right.
You know? So, I mean,
it's one of the weakest mayors in, by position in the nation, right?
Yeah, the it totally is. It totally is. So people sort of think, you know, he's the guy. So, I mean, the struggle's real. I mean, it's a very it's a very hard thing. But I take this blame squarely on voters.
Right.
And honestly, I used to be one of those people before I moved, because I used to live, you know, on the close and west side, and I moved out here, and it's like, wow. So, because I remember when I got out here, they said, well, you know, Portland, you know, East Portland's like the stepkid, right? And I thought, nah, it's ridiculous. Well, you know, I don't know. But I'd like to think that, you know, some of it just has to do with the topography, is my opinion. But, you know, either way, we definitely have some really, people aren't safe out here. And I know that sounds like I'm sort of exaggerating, but I really mean that. I mean, we just had a 67-year-old neighbor mugged and knocked unconscious. I mean,
this man, and I
actually know his wife, and I hadn't met him, but my girlfriend lives across the street from him, and I'm over at her place a few times a week. But I mean, so this isn't like just somebody I'm telling you a story about, right? I mean, like, I'm connected to this person. And he went to the Quickie Mart, and you know, it's 6 o'clock at night. Right now it's light at six.
Yep.
He literally didn't even know what happened. He came to, and he saw somebody's feet, and he thought he just blacked out. So he said, hey, can you help me up? And the guy just kept walking, and he put it all together and realized the guy hit him cold, took his bag, and was walking out. So he must have been unconscious for three, two, one. But, you know, and I'm sure you heard, but, you know, there was a TriMet driver stabbed on Thursday night at Gateway.
Actually, I hadn't heard that. Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, and then there's that 16-year-old that was stabbed by an unknown person in the Madison area. You know,
yeah.
No one's been arrested. We got shootings in Lent. Nobody's been arrested. I mean, shootings like going through people's houses.
Oh, hey, I live in Rockwood, and I had a drive-by shooting right across the street from my house last summer.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. It's just, you know, I just can't even... I mean, the camps for us, it's just moving them down the road. You know, they clean it up. They move somewhere else. Then you have other neighbors that are, you know, there's like pockets of crime wherever they move. So we
right.
can totally track and see that. You know, I think as I've gotten myself more and more entrenched in this, I think there's two solutions. Number one, people need to get their rear end down to the county and the city and speak. And I think they need to start paying attention to who is in office and what they're saying and what they're voting on. Even though it's a pain in the butt, even though you got a full-time job, even though you're busy with the family, it's got to be a priority, because if your area is safe right now, it's not going to be much longer. Because it's getting worse. I can tell you that right now. And we can totally impact this, and we can make it better, but we've got to hold people accountable that make decisions. And I think the second piece is that and this is touchy and controversial, but people have got to stop giving people money whenever they panhandle. You know, you're absolutely keeping them from, I'm sorry, I interrupted you, but.
No, I'm interrupting you, but I agree with you 100% because you're just feeding the addiction.
Yeah, and even if they're not addicted, you're keeping them from getting help. You're keeping them from reaching out to service. I've heard, as I've gone out and talked to some people that are living outside, you know, they're like, look, we ain't hungry, you know. There's places to eat all over. I mean, this is why sometimes you'll notice, like, if you pay attention, somebody will drive up to get onto a highway, and they'll give somebody food, and if you watch them sometimes, they just dump it. You know, they're not hungry. And, you know, it was like 2 days ago I had drove up the 58th, 84 and 58th, that exit. And mm-hmm. there was a bag. There was nobody there. There's regularly panhandlers there, but they weren't there. It was about 6 o'clock or so. And there was a bag there that I could see through. And the bag had socks and water in it. And I thought, you know, there's somebody who thinks they're being a really good person pulling up and, you know, here's this. And the person just left it there. There's no value. So I think, you know, I'm encouraging people, and I want people to feel safe and all that, but use your judgment. But, you know, we just need to get out and talk to people. You know, if you talk to people, if you have a presence, number one, if they're up to no good, they're like, oh, I'm being watched, sort of like whenever you have a shoplifter in a store. Second mm-hmm. of all, like, you know, you don't have to be, you can be totally polite and open-hearted and just be like, you know, what's going on? Why are you here? Like, what's your next step? What's keeping you from housing? Because sometimes, like, we had somebody tell us, like, he's like, I don't, my ID was stolen. I was living out of my car. I was doing drugs. I, you know, I cleaned up, but, you know, my car was broken into and my ID was stolen. And then he lived at, he was in California. And so our neighborhood, a few people in our neighborhood worked to get him ID. I didn't have a lot to do with that, but I do know him and I know the story. You know, there were some neighbors that really worked hard on that. And I wouldn't say it was super hard. I would just say it took something to get the man his ID, but that got him a job, you know? And
wow.
So sometimes
awesome.
Like, you know, it's like figuring out what people's thing is. And, you know, I've had some people, it's like, I'm getting ready to, I know I need to get clean. I've been clean before. It was a gal I was talking with. You know, she's like, my boyfriend and I want to get clean. We've been clean before. That's how we met. Like, we got mixed up in this again because, you know, it helps us stay up at night. And I'm just not ready today. And I'm like, well, I'm coming back. I'm going to keep telling you, like, you're better than this. Like, this is no kind of life for you. And, you know, it's like, you know, and it's like she's crying while I'm talking to her. But, I mean, speaking of our county, and I realize we don't have unlimited funds, but if you look at national things, we are spending more money than I think it's 47 other states on these things. And so I want to know why, like, for example, if somebody wants to go to Hooper or whatever, it takes, like, our needle exchange is giving out 5 million needles, 5 million needles a year in Multnomah County. Do you know our population?
Just in Multnomah County?
Yes. 5 million.
Oh,
and they do, it is a needle exchange, and they claim that they collect a tiny bit more than all of them. And I'm going to just go with it. That's true. But I have been there at the needle exchange, and I have seen, I saw a couple different people, but there's one that comes in mind that took 5,000 needles. And I know that it was 5,000 needles because the boxes have 500 apiece. Mm-hmm. And I want to know, or they have 1,000 apiece, excuse me. And I want to know why he's selling those on the black market. You know,
wow.
It's like, and this is like allowed, like the needle exchange used to be, you come in, you get your three or whatever. The average user is using about, if they're using clean needles each time, and hopefully they are, they'll use 3 needles a day. So why anybody needs that many whenever it's open on Tuesdays and Fridays? But we have really unsensible spending. We have people that are working while we're at our day jobs in the city that are absolutely not doing what they're voted to do. Because what I voted for was for somebody to keep me safe and help those who need help. That's what I expect for my tax dollars. You know?
Basic services.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just, you know, I really, if anything happens from this call, and I don't need anybody to take my word for it, I would just like somebody to go, gee, what can I do? And I think that the pieces are is starting to communicate with the elected officials about what your wishes are. And the second piece is like starting to connect with these people in your neighborhood on the street. You know, I find, you think about what leads you to addiction and how much might have gone wrong for that to happen. And because there's a lot of people that are functional addicts that still have homes. You know what I mean? There just is. And so a lot of times it's also very isolating out there. And so I think that, like, you can be kind to somebody and helpful and still have boundaries. But I think that if we can just, like, love on people a little bit, more like dad, less like mom.
you know, well, just, even if mom's a hard ass, that's fine. I don't mind the gender.
Yeah. I just, you know, I'm being a stereotypical, which isn't fair, which, of course, is not okay in today's day and age. At all. No, I'm sort of a hard-ass kind of gal, so I carry a lot of masculine energy myself. But, you know, it's, you know, I think I'm talking 1950s personalities. But, it's, but it's a little, I think it's just, it's important for people to stop driving down the road and ignoring everything, or like, oh, they're on the side and I see their sad face and I'm going to give them money. Like, we can do better than this. We can do better than this. And I don't think that if we expect, we're in a big mess. And I think if we just expect our city and our county to take care of it without our input or without our participation or without us being informed, I just think that that is absolutely not going to happen. So,
well, and that's the way it's supposed to be, right? It's a participatory democracy where they're not our leaders, they're our representatives, and we're supposed to go and tell them what we want from them.
Yeah. And somehow that's not happening, I don't think. I mean, we do have a lot of activists that that go down to city council and yell them down and intimidate. I mean, we have a lot.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because there's a lot of activists on the other side advocating for more openness, or, you know, more fewer consequences for this kind of behavior, right?
Right. Yeah, I've encountered them. So I think number one, I think we're very polarizing right now as a society, and I think that we want to blame people. And I think that sometimes I get frustrated, and the things that we try to put out where I'll have somebody, you know, start sort of sparring with me or sparring with the group about, you know, well, you believe this and I don't even know. And so, and it's like, well, be upset at me or whatever, but why don't you go out there and, like, can we all agree? I just don't understand. Like, you and I are going to disagree about something if we talk about enough topics.
Sure.
And so we might even adamantly disagree. So I think that for me, I think this is the simplicity. We can all agree that we don't want this filth in our city. Yes, please? Can we all agree that we don't want, like, a rat? We don't want a hepatitis break. We don't want rats everywhere because we have
How dare you question their lifestyle choice?
Yeah. I mean, this is what's interesting about that thing, is that we, one of the things we did is Montevilla Park, which is at 82nd and Gleason.
Yes.
It was, had so much camping in it last summer that, they were starting to take apart the trees for firewood.
Oh my God.
And there was, you know, of course, trash and needles, and the porta potty was being used to shoot up because it's, you know, an enclosed space. And there was a lot of drug activity, and they were permanently camped underneath the facility that has the picnic tables and is covered. I can't, what you call that?
Yeah, so the gazebo or whatever.
Yeah, the gazebo or whatever. So they were, so we had written, our group had, you know, written to the mayor's office in the county and called on our expectations, also Portland Parks, and the news came out, which seems to be the way we always get them to, you know, seems to be, oh, you know, if I'm going to sort of get smacked in public, you know, my hand smacked in public, I'm going to do something. So it was,
hey, all press is good press, right?
Right. So that did get cleaned up. And then we continued to go through, like, within neighbors, like, we would all go at certain times, like, throughout the week, and sort of kept it moving along. And really, it wasn't just the homeless. Like, there was a lot of drugs there. And we have a lot of people who just sort of hang out outside, but they're housed. Believe me, they're housed. They just sort of seem like they're homeless because, you know, they'll just park their car and wait for people to bring them stolen merchandise and pay them out and for drugs and whatever. So, and I say a lot, I don't know that there's a lot. There's a handful of people in our neighborhood that we very much know, and they're very much trouble. And so getting that cleaned up, back to the park and kind of what your rights are, you know, we all agree as a city that a park is for leisure. That's why there's rules. That's why there's rules about no overnight camping. I mean, we used to have that rule, and it wasn't with the homeless epidemic. It was more like because the park is an agreement that we all have about here's how we use it, here's how we care for it. So therefore, these are the rules. Like one of the rules in the park is you can't be drunk in the park. You can't have an open container in the park. No smoking, no fires in the park, you know. And we had slipped on those rules at Montevilla Park. You know, there was definitely campfires, and there was also literally you could watch people lighting up drugs, right?
Sure.
So I think that what I'm saying is that the standard of what our boundaries are should be the same regardless of people and their status. Where they live or where they don't live. But I certainly think that we should try to help people. You know, it's interesting, as I've gone out, and I haven't been out as much recently, but there was a period of time where I was out a few times a week, you know, doing walks, connecting with people, sort of like what's going on. And I'll pick it up again now that it's warming up too. And we've done it in the cold months particularly. But anyway, they are, there is an issue where you know they're moving around. I think I'm losing my train of thought on this one, unfortunately. I don't even know that I've really helped assist where people are at, but I think the reason that I've taken the time to be on this call is because I want people to care, because I can't, you can't, handful of people that I know cannot move this tide back to so that we all are safe and we're cared for. I know what I was going to say. Please give me the opportunity to say it. What I was going to say is all these walks and all these visits, I have never seen a social service person at any of these camps, and it pisses me off. So I'm asking myself, you know, you sit in these facilities, how the city works is the county has certain monies, right? Some of it's federal, some of it's from the state, et cetera. And that money goes to, they have some things that they assist, like their own shelter, et cetera, but most of it goes to private charities to administer help. So places like Join or Inside Out or whatever. And so those people sort of like at Join and Joins at 82nd and Halsey, it's sort of like they got to go in and get help. And that's their job if you're on the street. And my comment is just, we do have service resistant people. Can we all just admit it? And that doesn't mean they're bad. They might be mentally ill. They don't think they need help. They're an ass and they want to break the rules, or they're a good person and they're confused and they don't know which way north. I don't know with all, I mean, everybody has.
But we're not doing anything. It's not even service resistant or whatever. I mean, we should be doing all of that stuff, right? And we're not doing any of it.
Yeah. So get out of your office and stop getting on Facebook and complaining about what people are doing that you don't like, and get out there and connect with them and talk to the story. And I'm telling you, I know people are not connecting with these people, because I did my own social experiment with neighbors and started talking to people to ask them why they were out there, what was going on, what the next step was, what was keeping them there, whatever, you know, the ways in which we asked them. And it's not because housing isn't affordable. Now, there is some people who definitely are going to have a gap. I mean, but I'm saying, like, when there's a whole bunch of issues that they need fixed before they need a house. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Well, I mean, they obviously need shelter. That's the primary thing, but they're not going to be able to maintain that shelter if they don't fix the underlying problems.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember I was thinking about this the other day, and I don't know if anybody else has thought about this, so it's worth mentioning. You know, you've got this like, remember whenever, like, the meth epidemic started happening, like, in the 90s and around here, and, you know, and they would sort of go into these houses and, like, the, you know, there'd be, like, a toddler there who, like, you know, was, his diapers were all over and the place was a disgusting
mess. Well, that stuff
mess
still happens.
And, yeah, and so, you know, this was sort of the meth thing, but you can kind of see that going on in the tents.
Yep.
There's like a, the other day we were cleaning up one in our neighborhood, and they sort of like kind of sometimes will abandon them. They'll catch fire and they'll leave or whatever. They leave because there's a sweep or whatever. And there was a tent, and it literally, it was like you couldn't see the floor of the tent. There was trash with needles, with a sleeping bag. I mean, it was like, I was like, I couldn't even imagine that somebody slept there even once.
Yeah,
I don't, and you know, and the other thing is like when you're pulling alongside the road and you're like, oh, you need a tarp, you need a sleeping bag, you needed this, you needed that. The reason you see that stuff thrown everywhere is that they don't care. They're just going to get another one because some other person's going to give them whatever. And it's
right.
Just,
and
let
and,
them go to services. Let them go to the professionals that know how to engage with them and help them. I mean, because we're
it also seems to me that the public resources need to be redirected in a way where, like you're saying, those people are just sitting in their offices not doing anything. You never see a public service person out there. They should be going out and proactively getting the people that the services that they need. You know, if you've got service resistant people, fine, but there may be people that have been homeless for, you know, a period of years where it's become normal for them and they don't even look for assistance or a hand up anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, we, you know, there's definitely, I don't think it's appropriate for this call because it's, you know, so involved, but there's certainly a lot of barriers for help. Definitely.
Right.
And, and there's definitely, you know, we had had a gentleman, that we knew that we had helped, worked with him. He was in and out of stuff, had some medical stuff. He was the mythical hobo. He had no drug problem. He wasn't mentally ill. He was literally a working man, had something happen with his brain bleeding and basically couldn't carry on a job, was very private and ended up homeless. He ended up dying. He was on where he was camping. I suspect foul play. He fell down. He was down the embankment. They didn't find him. They wouldn't open up a missing persons. It was like 60 days later, they found him this last summer. Very upsetting for so many of my neighbors who knew him.
Yeah,
I
wow.
called him before that happened because I'd known him at that point for almost like many months. And I called him and said, we'd like to invite you to live in our home. And, you know, I had to know he was safe, et cetera. But by that point, he was already gone. And my point is, you know, is that like it's not safe out there. And, you know, he had been in and out of like medical things that would go on. And there was even a medical he was at and they just dispatched him right out to the street. So there's definitely like, and they knew that he was homeless. And so, and he, this was a man that worked for the Park Service whenever he was younger. Like he, this is a respectable, not to say that anyone deserves this if they are not respectable, but I'm saying that this could happen to anybody. You know, he just happened to not be married and be living with somebody that could help support him and make sure that he didn't go houseless, right? So I think, you know, we definitely have some people that are not getting help and the barriers are really hard and we try to work with somebody and we, you know, really try to work with one person. Like, it's really frustrating for us. So there's all that too, but I think it starts with like getting involved and talking to the city council and the county counselors, commissioners, what we call them. And then we also stop enabling this. Like we try to talk to people and connect with them and figure out what they want instead of sort of getting our conscience clean by giving them money or water or socks. And those things are great if they ask for those things, but like, don't, like, you're not off the hook. Like if you want change, it's got to start with you. And for me, it's less about the trash bothers me. The needles bother me. You know, I had a neighbor get pricked with a needle trying to garden. Like this is a problem. However, all that is like, nothing compared to the human suffering that is going on out there. And whenever we're in our cars with our windows up and we're driving by, like, we don't even understand, like, the stuff that's going on out there. To, like, people are being totally horrifically, like, it's just, it's no good. It's no good what's going on.
Right. And it's turning our city into something that's less safe, less livable, less walkable, and less appealing. So
yeah,
it's not good. It's something that we should all be ashamed of and working hard to fix.
Yeah. All hands on deck.
Absolutely. All right. Angela Todd, thanks so much for being on the podcast. I want to say real quick, this is something that I've thought about doing for a long time. I've never actually done it, which is what you're doing now, going out and actually talking to the people that are on the streets and have these issues that they're suffering from and figuring out exactly what they want instead of listening to the talking heads at the city council. You know, so
yeah.
I really want to commend you for doing that. You actually took the action that I've thought about taking for a long time and haven't done. So
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So where can everybody find you on social media? Or you know, I know you've been on the news quite a bit, so where can people connect with you?
So we're Montevilla.org, and also we're on Facebook as Montevilla Initiative. And those are good ways to get in touch with me or us.
Outstanding. Well, Angela Todd, thanks so much for everything you do. Thanks for coming on the podcast and telling us what's really happening on the streets instead of the sanitized version that we hear from City Hall.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking out the Behind the Curtain podcast. I want to thank my buddy Brian Futch for providing me the theme song, I Am America, produced by Cass Anawati. Join us next Wednesday for another episode of Behind the Curtain with Jeff Reynolds.
Sailed here from across the ocean with nothing else but his dream for a better life. His folks over there shook their heads at such a crazy notion, but deep down in his heart he knew he was right. Cleared the way for you and me. You can still hear his spirit sing. I am America. This land is my land, America. I know one day after I'm gone, someone will carry this dream along. What makes this country so strong? I am America. Grandpa volunteered for the war across the ocean. There's no price for his country he wouldn't pay. Like so many others, he fought for the cause with great devotion. And just like his daddy, he led the way. Yeah. His stories have faded with his years, but his eyes say it loud and clear. Down the things he was taught, like loving your neighbor.